Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Elizabeth Warren's Surreptitious Socialism. And Richard, that is the title of a recent piece of yours at Defining Ideas, and it was prompted by a piece of legislation being proposed by Senator Elizabeth Warren, which she recently touted in the Wall Street Journal, of all places.
When Elizabeth wrote this particular piece, what she said is that the great defect of American capitalism is it gives in corporate matters inordinate affair and inordinate weight to the shareholders and doesn't take into account other stakeholders, that is, people like employees and suppliers and customers and regional people who have an interest in what the corporation does. She claims that this leads to a certain degree of imbalance in returns in which the rich get richer and everybody else picks up the crumbs. And she proposes essentially that we change the entire system of incorporation in several ways. First, what she wants to do is to make all corporate charters for existing and future companies federal, which means that you wipe out the state of Delaware and every other state which has issued these corporations. And then, in order to get your corporate charter, what you have to do is to agree with to whatever terms the United States wishes to impose on these charters. And she proposes to have about 40% of the shareholders of all of the or the directors of these companies to be essentially union members or community members of one sort or another. And she claims that if you do this particular kind of situation, what it will do is it will manage to create the higher degree of equity without impairing the efficiency of the overall operation. And it's a pretty heroic moment. There's never been any situation like this ever anywhere on the face of the globe. But it takes an inordinate amount of confidence to be sure that something which has always been rejected and has never been tried is, in fact, the solution to all our ills.
All right. So let's go through this piece by piece, Richard. We live in an era when it is very much in vogue to talk about the need for corporate responsibility. And Elizabeth Warren, as you said, is arguing that these companies are under a social obligation and we can't abide a system in which they view their only responsibility. She takes on the Milton Friedman argument head on. We can't abide a system in which they view their only responsibility as providing value to their shareholders. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, the point is the only responsibility as directors is one thing, but it's certainly that a corporation, in effect, has to obey all the other laws that are placed upon ordinary individuals. So, for example, if you're a sole proprietor and you're faced with a demand for unionization, if it's compliant with the National Labor Relations Act, you have to do collective bargaining as is required. If you're subject to the minimum wage law, you have to pay the minimum wage law. And so it is with every other positive document. In addition, of course, what happens is there are many people like bondholders who certainly have a very large stake in the corporation if anything goes sour. And the uniform response to that is that the corporation only owes fiduciary duties to the shareholders, but it owes positive duties under law to deal with externalities like environmental problems or with labor issues of one kind or another. And with certain people like bondholders, it's duty-bound, obviously, in order to get their money to enter into arm's-length contractual negotiations, and that could then determine the sort of division of rights and responsibilities before foreclosure, after foreclosure, in bankruptcy, out of bankruptcy, or whatever it is. And the system has worked amazingly well in terms of what it does. And so traditional people, if they were starting to think about the question of what you do with imbalances and inequities, they would always start to think about which of these particular external levers that you'd want to manipulate. Nobody would ever think of trying to put somebody from the outside onto the inside. And I'm just going to give you two reasons why this is important. One is fiduciaries can only serve single masters, and conflicts of interest mean either they can't do anything at all or anything they want, both of which are unacceptable. So modern public corporations are always designed to have a single broad class of public shareholders who are in identical position, so that it's very difficult to benefit one group of shareholders without benefiting the others. The moment you have preferred shareholders and special shareholders, preferred shareholders like low-risk options because they don't get the upside. Common shareholders want high-risk options because they are not happy with a fixed return. And so you see these conflicts, and you have to start to avoid them. A second problem is that when you start to do this, you have to share all sorts of information that you have in running this particular corporation with all the members of the board of directors. And so to give you but one illustration of what the problem is, some time ago, the city of Oakland had the bright idea of trying to take over the football team, nationalize it, as it were, in order to make sure that it could not move to Los Angeles. And the league refused to allow this to happen because they said, is when we go into these meetings with all of the chiefs of our various companies, we've put on the board incredibly sensitive information about legal exposures to this, that, and the other thing, and about our financial plans and our personnel relationships and our advertisement campaigns. And we can't share that information with somebody who has a fiduciary duty to disclose it to somebody else because all our confidences will be lost. Well, Ms. Warren's program has exactly this kind of problem. These corporations are dealing with all sorts of very difficult things. What's the optimal strategy in labor negotiations with a union? Well, if one of the members of the union is sitting there on the board and gets all of that information, this entire negotiation becomes a complete charade. And so what's happened is she has never thought through any of the implications of this with respect to the myriad functions of boards and with other kinds of organizations. And if she did think about that, she would certainly understand that there's a very good reason why everybody on the face of the globe at every time has essentially said that fiduciary duties are narrowly focused. And if you went to this broader situation, you could never run a board in a sensible fashion, which means that long-term planning would not survive, and the capital value of shares would plummet in the United States. There'd be a mass migration to take existing companies overseas. God knows whether or not, for example, under her proposal, whether any company which does business in the United States or has plans in the United States would be subject to this. So you could take Michelin sitting there in Paris and say, well, since you have a plant in South Carolina, it turns out that you have to have 40% of your French board consisting of American representatives in Columbia, South Carolina. The thing is just too bizarre for words.
Part of Senator Warren's theory of the case here is that there was a simpler time, not that long ago, she argues, when corporations pushed their profits mostly back into their companies and their workers, and that now the dynamic has changed and that they're much more often just extracted by shareholders. And so those wealthy investors are getting wealthier and the ordinary working people that they employ are getting the screws put to them. And she, by the way, in this article cites this as a cause of wage stagnation. So, Richard, how well does that case hold up to scrutiny?
Well, the difficulty with this particular situation is she doesn't understand what the causes of wage stagnation were. So to give you a kind of a simple number, if you start looking at wage improvements in the Obama administration, they were negligible, and there was enormous efforts on the part of every government agency in order to improve those. Now, when we're getting to ourselves under the Trump administration, where most of these special pleadings are no longer there, there's signs fairly early on that the wage picture for people at the bottom of the pyramid are improving. So to give you but one figure, the percentage of unemployed teenagers of those interested in going into the workforce now has been as low as it's been in the last 52 years. Well, what's the source of it? Non-enforcement of government obligations. Why is that the case? Because when government decides to put obligations of one kind or another on private contracting parties, minimum wage laws, or whatever else it turns out to be, the distortions are greatest at the bottom end of the market. Somebody earning $25 an hour is not going to be hit by a change in the minimum wage from $7 to $15. Somebody earning $11 an hour is going to be heavily hit. The Obama people were constantly pushing at the bottom, and so what happened is you saw employers shifting away from this. How do the shifts take place? One is you shift the higher paid employees so as to avoid the regulatory burden. Another thing is you start shipping work overseas because you then have a more favorable foreign environment. And third, what you often tend to do is to shift from labor into capital-intensive devices because machines don't go on strike and machines don't need work breaks and machines aren't subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act. The other point is you have to understand what's being distributed. When you start putting together, the only thing that you have to worry about is the distribution of profits. Well, the profits are only determined after you've figured out all of your expenses, including the various wage payments. So if you're going to look at it in this particular fashion, if you're paying out a lot in wages and a lot in compliance costs, and then you give the rest out to your shareholders, that doesn't mean that you've done badly by everybody else. You've just been in compliance with all of your other obligations in terms of the way in which this a type situation is. So you never want to get yourself into the kind of position where you box yourself into these things and assume that no matter what you do, these wages are going to stagnate. They're not going to stagnate if you take your throat off the foot or the neck of the American business population and let people more or less organize their affairs in more or less in their own way. And the last point that one has to make is there is nothing bad about a distribution from a corporation. So if you were talking about large corporations with large pools of money, it is very difficult for these organizations, both structurally and in terms of their financial position, to take high-risk ganders on new propositions because they get lost in the bureaucracy on the one hand. And even if you have a $100 billion corporation and you have a new device which goes from $100 million to $1 billion, it barely sees the bottom line. You make distributions to shareholders, and the shareholders then invest in venture capital firms, and the venture capital firms then decide to go into high-risk investment, that's where the real growth is going to be. And one of the catastrophic consequences of Ms. Warren's situation is that she somehow assumes that you could get a company to start and everything is going hunky-dory, it's worth $1 billion, and all of a sudden it hits these obligations. Well, most of the investments in venture capital are not designed to make a $100 million corporation into a $300 million corporation. The risk is too high for that. And you're trying to get them into a $100 billion corporation or a $50 billion corporation. So you backload this thing onto Facebook, onto Google, onto eBay, onto Amazon, any major American corporation that you care to mention. And what you will find is that none of them could have started because of this huge notch effect. She lives in a very unhappy world in which all dynamic elements are ignored, all efficiency elements are ignored, and she seems to think that the only thing that matters in these cases is her own rather undeveloped sense of equity.
Senator Warren lodges a criticism here that is similar to one that we heard from Hillary Clinton during the 2016 campaign, namely that corporations are led astray by short-termism, that more and more CEOs are increasingly compensated through equity, and as a result, they have an incentive to drive up those share prices by hook or by crook with no regard for the long term. Is that something that you regard as a serious problem?
She's got it exactly backwards. What happens is there was a time in which you paid corporate officers largely in cash, and they were generally indifferent to the long-term prospects of a corporation because they took their money and run. So every responsible corporate board decided, no, we really have to mix this up a bit. And the way in which you mix it up is you give some cash, much of it, by the way, in the form of annual bonuses at the end of the year. So oftentimes you have very low base salaries on the one hand. And then what you do is you have high bonuses. They also give you stock and they also give you options. The way the stock is done is it's typically restricted, so you can't get rid of it all immediately and thereby separate yourself from the fortunes of the company. And the same thing with respect to your options. You can't assign them before you exercise them, and after you exercise them, many times you have to keep the shares. So what everybody is trying to do is essentially is to make the alignment between the officers of the corporation and the corporation better by giving them a long-term stake. Now, if she starts talking about quarterly earnings, she would be correct if the only thing anybody ever looked at when they did some kind of an evaluation was the quarterly earnings statement and ignored everything else. But when you're pricing shares, that's a piece of information, but it's only one piece of information. And essentially what you're trying to do is to figure out in the share price what the long-term discounted stream of profits is going to look like. And that means that the shareholders are always making forward judgments. So if you take away the quarterly reports, there's going to be less information. It will not improve the market. And in effect, if you try to shift the compensation away from shares, it's going to encourage the very kind of short-termism that you don't want. What Ms. Warren does not understand is that the directors of these corporations all have slightly different situations, but all of them understand this constant problem of agency costs, that is, situations where the benefits to the officers sometimes diverge from the benefits to the shareholders, and they try to take steps to mitigate those particular losses. They actually know what's going on. What is so extraordinary is somebody who doesn't have the most feeble grasp as to how these organizations work is absolutely convinced that if you make one one sort of change or another, it will change what she perceives to be a very large problem, when in effect, if you actually look at the equity markets in the United States, they're extraordinarily efficient because they allow anybody who gets information from independent sources to use it to buy stock. And it also puts a kind of sensible restriction on the amount of self-dealing that can come from insider trading. So all the mechanisms in place are designed to deal with this. We can tweak one or another of them in various ways, but this sort of frontal assault, in effect, represents what can only be described as a conscious indifference or cosmic ignorance about the ways in which these operations work. And so what is important to understand is that you cannot, when you're doing these sorts of things, rely on this sort of impressionistic two-sentence sorts of arguments when literally you're prepared to federalize trillions of dollars in national assets and put the control of it in a single board, which she would like to appoint. And when you talk about the board, remember Ms. Warren is the person who put together the Consumer Fraud Protection Bureau, one of the worst designed boards ever. And if you had something like this, you could then have a board insulated from presidential control and political influence of five people who will essentially be the most five powerful people in the entire business world of the United States. So if you take her dystopian view of how administrative law ought to work and then match it against her total ignorance about how it is that financial and corporate markets work, you have a recipe here for disaster of a worldwide capacity. This is the kind of legislation that can turn the United States into Venezuela.
Richard, let's close by playing this hypothetical all the way out. Let's say that in 2021, a President Warren with congressional majorities of self-styled Democratic Socialists was to pass this legislation, to what degree would it be vulnerable in the courts?
It would be highly vulnerable as far as I'm concerned, because what happens is essentially what you would argue is that by essentially putting your people in charge of the corporation, what you've done is you've taken the assets from the shareholders and given them to somebody else. There would be a question as to whether or not this would be, quote, a mere regulation for which you would have a relatively low rate of review under rational basis test, or whether it would be regarded as a physical expropriation since you actually control the assets by your particular interest. If it's the latter, then she clearly loses. If it's the former, you have to be able to argue that there's some kind of general rational improvement coming out of this system. And since the arguments that are made are so vanishingly weak, it seems to me that she could not be able to make this out. But, you know, you have to be scared about all this. You know that for many years before the whole thing got blown up, is I worked on some of the Fannie and Freddie situations, which were outright expropriations. And in a district court opinion in February of 2017, two judges, Doug Ginsburg, conservative, and Patricia Millett, I think it was, who was on the liberal side, said it's okay to say to people, you own the shares of the corporation. What are you complaining about? All we took were all the dividends. All we took were all the liquidation value. And all we took were the voting rights. And so if you actually have a grotesque decision like that, which allows you to turn a corporate share into a, basically a hollow, empty vessel, we keep the fruit and you keep the peel. God knows what could happen in this case. So a lot of this is going to depend on who sits on the Supreme Court and on the lower courts. There is, I'm afraid, in the United States today, a systematic form of populism in which this sort of ignorance sort of takes over every kind of analysis that you start to see. And it's really quite scary because it's hard to imagine anybody more ignorant on any of these issues than Elizabeth Warren.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.